I suspect for most of you, regardless of what your tradition might be, there are Bible stories you remember from your childhood. And perhaps they are old reliables like Noah in the ark or Jesus welcoming the little children. Maybe it's something a little more esoteric, like the story of Balaam's ass, or it's just weird, like some chapter from the book of Leviticus. My story is today's lesson from 1 Samuel. I've always had very strong impressions of how the tale unfolds. Now, according to some of the commentaries I've read, the story's message of Samuel's youthful, unquestioning faith is what should inspire me. And indeed, pastors apparently tell this story to kids, hoping that it will fire up a love of God in their hearts that will carry them through life. I never thought that. What spoke to me about this story were its atmospherics. I was able to imagine what the sanctuary in Shiloh looked like. I imagined it had big pillars inside, and then it was a dark place. Indeed, somewhat gloomy as the story unfolds at night. I often imagined young Samuel hearing that voice calling to him and getting up and looking for its source. And we know, according to the story, he keeps going back to Eli, mistaking God's voice for Eli's voice. The third time, Eli figures out what's going on. Samuel then goes and hears the Lord's message. And what a terrible, frightful message to lay on a young boy. But that's God's way. Eli insists that he be told what God said. And so Samuel shares the words of judgment. And as we know from the story, Samuel becomes a great prophet, and Eli's house will be cut off. I was very grateful that today's lesson fell this weekend. It really seemed appropriate for Martin Luther King Jr. celebration. And I originally thought I would talk about being called, how we might not recognize that at first. But ultimately, we need to hear the word and follow it wherever it might take us. It might take us to places that we find to be uncomfortable, places that challenge our preferred ways of seeing things. And then I'd be able to talk about Dr. King's life and how he went to Montgomery and Birmingham and Selma and Washington and ultimately Memphis. Nice little sermon, practically wrote itself. But as I sat with this text, I found myself focusing not on young Samuel, but on Eli the priest. Eli was old, his vision was failing, his sons were a complete and utter disaster. Earlier in the book, we are told how Hophni and Phinehas like to take the best parts of the sacrifices for themselves, how they hit on the women who came to pray. They were two bad apples. And what did Eli do? Well, when Hannah came to pray at the sanctuary, he told her to leave because he thought she was drunk. But while his sons were living the high life, were stealing, were fornicating, he turned a blind eye. The old man didn't necessarily have a vision problem that was restricted to his eyesight. But his spiritual vision failed him too. And as I thought about Eli, he wasn't so much a malefactor He wasn't an evildoer, but he was an enabler. He abetted the commission of sins. Now that's interesting. This whole notion of being complicit. He was complicit and he was complacent. He followed the rituals. He did the services. He offered the sacrifices. He followed God's way. And yet, he missed the point about doing what was right and just and calling out evil when he saw it, even when it was in his own household. And as I thought about this passage and what I might say, because it was sticking with me, I thought back to King's letter from Birmingham Jail. I don't know if you remember this, but while that was a publicized letter, it was a circular, it was addressed to 8 clergymen in Birmingham. People who do what I do. It was sent to some Protestant ministers and to a rabbi and to Catholic priests. And in that letter, he responded to a letter they had written to the local paper that decried outsiders coming into the community and stirring up trouble. So King, sitting in his jail cell, thought about this and felt the need to pen a response. And he began to write in the margins of the newspaper and then the little scraps of paper that a black trustee in the jail gave to him, and finally pads of paper that his lawyers got for him. He first began to address the critique of the pastors. And he pointed out that he really wasn't an outsider, though he was from Atlanta, but the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had an affiliate at work in Birmingham, the Alabama Christian Human Rights Committee. So it was local people who were speaking up and taking action. And then he addressed the issue of creating a disturbance. He said he could understand why people might not like that. But he asked people to think about things from the perspective of blacks in the South. America had been settled at the beginning of the 1600s. And now it was the middle of the 1900s. And our national promise of being a land of the free had not been fully realized. And to tell people who were denied the right to use bathrooms or water fountains, or that they could go into a store, that they could sit at a counter, was wrong. People had said, wait for things to work through the courts. It will happen. The time will come. Well, that was all very well and fine if you were one of the white Protestant businessmen in Birmingham. But if you were a black mother out on a shopping trip with her child who needed to use the restroom and they couldn't go because there was a whites-only sign, then maybe that argument wasn't very compelling. Maybe justice needed to be fought for and secured in a different way. Now, most of us here, I suspect, are fans of law and order. We like the streets to be safe. We want the stores to be patrolled. We don't want to have to worry about our kids and where they go. And so when injustices occur involving law enforcement or public accommodation, we probably don't notice. We may hear about it secondhand, or read a story or see something on TV, but most of us don't have that experience. And it can deaden us to the reality. I'm not going to read the entire letter from Birmingham Jail for you. But I want to read this passage that King addressed to the church, to us. And yes, he was speaking to the ministers, but the fact is he's also addressing the church as an institution. Let me take note of my other major disappointment. I have been so greatly disappointed with the white church and its leadership. Of course, there are some notable exceptions. I am not unmindful of the fact that each of you has taken some significant stands on this issue. I commend you, Reverend Stallings, for your Christian stand on this past Sunday in welcoming Negroes to your worship service on a non-segregated basis. I commend the Catholic leaders of this state for integrating Spring Hill College several years ago. But despite these notable exceptions, I must honestly reiterate that I have been disappointed with the church. I do not say this as one of those negative critics who can always find something wrong with the church. I say this as a minister of the gospel who loves the church, who is nurtured in its bosom, who has been sustained by its spiritual blessings, and who will remain true to it as long as the cord of life shall lengthen. When I was suddenly catapulted into the leadership of the bus protest in Montgomery, Alabama a few years ago, I felt that we'd be supported by the white church. I felt that the white ministers, priests, and rabbis of the South would be among our strongest allies. Instead, some have been outright opponents, refusing to understand the freedom movement and misrepresenting its leaders. All too many others have been more cautious than courageous and have remained silent behind the anesthetizing security of stained glass windows. In spite of my shattered dreams, I came to Birmingham with the hope that the white religious leadership of this community would see the justice of our cause and with deep moral concern would serve as the channel through which our just grievances could reach the power structure. I had hoped that each of you would understand, but again, I have been disappointed. I had heard numerous Southern religious leaders admonish their worshipers to comply with the desegregation decision because it is a law. But I have longed to hear white ministers declare, follow this decree because integration is morally right and because the Negro is your brother. In the midst of blatant injustices inflicted upon the Negro, I have watched white churchmen stand on the sideline and mouth pious irrelevancies and sanctimonious trivialities. In the midst of a mighty struggle to rid our nation of racial and economic injustice, I have heard many ministers say, those are social issues with which the gospel has no real concern. And I have watched many churches commit themselves to a completely otherworldly religion which makes a strange, unbiblical distinction between body and soul, between the sacred and the secular. Those words were written more than 50 years ago. But change a phrase here or an emphasis there, and they could still be written today. A lot of us have been dispirited over the last year or plus. Things have been said, things have been done that we find to be outrageous. Some in the church have spoken up, but have done so in a way that I at least find is part of a political effort. Others have chosen to endorse what is happening, and I find that to be appalling. We in the church need to offer a witness on this issue. We can't be silent. We can't worry about what people are going to say. Otherwise, we are going to be damned like Eli. Immigration is a tough issue. and we could deploy facts and statistics around whether it is good or bad, who loses jobs, who gets them. But we're not talking about statistics here. We're talking about our brothers and sisters. That is the bottom line. And the reason we need to talk about this in the church is because we read throughout Scripture in the Old Testament and the New that we were strangers in a strange land, and we should not forget that. We need to welcome the stranger. We need to offer hospitality and care. Not tolerate people or abide them, but welcome them. Some of us here can trace our roots back to the Pilgrims. Some of us can trace them back to people coming through Ellis Island in New York or Castle Island in Boston 100 years ago. There is a word I could use to describe how somebody would have seen you. I'm not going to share that vulgarity. To talk about entire nations and peoples the way the president supposedly did is wrong. And we need to say that. In 2017, I shouldn't have to give a sermon about a speech that Martin Luther King preached more than half a century ago. But here we are. Maybe you liked Obama, maybe you did not. But I hope that at least when he was elected president, you felt a certain pride that our country had overcome an obstacle. It looked like things were getting better. I remember John McCain offering very gracious words when he conceded the election. There was a sense of possibility. Not so much whether you liked his platform, but maybe, just maybe, we were letting some of our old animuses go away. Well, so much for that dream. We now live in a day and age when people feel comfortable offering racist sentiments, saying racist things, and it is wrong. This is not the kind of country I want to live in. It's not the kind of world. And I don't believe that it is the kind of place that Jesus would have us inhabit. This is a raw issue. But we can't hide from it. This is what the church is called to do. So I'm going to give you some advance warning here. We're going to be discussing a statement in favor of the Immigration Solidarity Network that has arisen here in New Hampshire. And Mission and Social Action and the deacons are going to be presenting a resolution that we adopt a position supporting the network. We're not going to become a sanctuary church. Not ready for that. But we are going to plant a flag in the ground saying this is who we are. And this is what we as a congregation believe we should support. Eli went to worship on a regular basis. Eli offered sacrifices. Eli, I am sure, could quote scripture backwards and forwards to you. I'm sure he observed all the festivals. But when it really mattered, he fell down on the job. My hope is that we won't be like Eli.